Darren Showtime Taylor, and I want to welcome you to Heart in the Pain. This episode, I'm going to do something that I'm not very comfortable with, but I'm going to have to get comfortable with, and that is talking about myself. Everybody talks about me, and I think that's a cool thing. You know, I wish they talked more about the rehabilitation side, but everybody is interested in the sports, and that's what got me here, so that's what we're going to talk about. But today, like I said, we're going to mainly focus on some of my history, more recent history in the beginning. I'm going to talk about since I've been released in the beginning from October 16th, 2020 until today. Today's date is the 13th of October. Tomorrow is Friday. I will have been released 2 years, so this is reflective. Then after that, I'm going to talk about some of the things that I did before I went to prison that a lot of people don't know about, but when you hear about it, you're going to be like, that was him? Right. It's really one incident, but I'm going to get into it. And then thirdly, I'm going to talk about specifically Sentinel Estate Prison and what we did there when it came to sports. Right. Because what we did there was almost a blueprint that set me up for when I got to San Quentin State Prison. Right. We want to focus on that and maybe touch on the Warriors. So let's get started. I went to the board on July the 15th, 2020, and I sat in front of Commissioner Anderson and two other commissioners. I had my lawyer there from For the People, Hillary Blout. And it was about an hour-long process with Commissioner Anderson has a reputation for being one of the most hardest commissioners in CDCR. Thankfully, Hillary Blout from For the People had me really, really prepared because what she told me was, and she asked me, who is the hardest, strictest commissioner? That's Anderson. Everybody know that. Anderson didn't deny a whole lot of people around here. And she said, well, that's who we're going to prepare you for. Now, also, I have a friend from inside. His name is Jack Benford, calling Big Body Benz. If you go on sanquentinnews.com and look at some of my old stories under Aaron Taylor, you'll find one of the stories where I did an interview on Jack Benford, a.k.a. Big Body Benz. I went by Ben Sale to prepare for board. And I told him that I was going to be facing Anderson, and he told me something that just stuck with me, and it stuck with me all the way through the board. It was, hey, man, Anderson don't deny people for nothing. People be in there bullshitting with Anderson. When you don't go in there and bullshit, you get your date. And so when I went into the board, I spoke straight to Anderson. I told him about my past. I let him know that I was aware of what brought me to prison, the traumas that I hadn't dealt with in my childhood, and how I was able to address them in some of the self-help groups before I came to the board. And so after that, I was granted parole. It was a 91-day wait. And you have to understand, I was arrested on August the 25th, 1994. And up until July the 15th, 2020, everything had kind of like cruised by after a while, you know, from 2002 all the way to right around the time I went to the board, it went by in a flash. There was so much stuff going on and I kept myself so busy that I really wasn't worried about it. And so up until that point, time went by pretty quick. But when I came out that board with a date from July 16th until October 16th, it seemed like it took the world. That was the longest 91 days of my life, knowing that after 26 years, right, I'm going to be free. There was nothing that was going to stop this. I had already passed all the tests, and I come home, and I came out to a world that was in the middle of a pandemic. The driver of the van that brought me from San Quentin all the way down to Glendale, California, bless his heart, he did exactly what I would have did. A man drove about 95 miles an hour the whole way back to L.A. from San Francisco. definitely got me home. And I remember coming on the 5 as you come from north headed south. And you come across the county line to let you know that you're in L.A. County again, coming from the Castaic side. And I remember the tears that came down my face because this was the first time I had been in Los Angeles again. And I wasn't wearing cuffs and I wasn't wearing jail clothes. And, you know, I cried in the back of the van. But the crazy part about what happened next. So a couple of days before then, I told all my partners what I was going to do after, you know, a man who spent 26 years in prison. I had some ideas that I wanted to take care of as soon as I got out, right? Unfortunately, when I sat in front of the correctional officers who took me to this motel, they told me that the manager was going to keep an eye on me. And if I was to bring anybody inside of that motel room that didn't belong in there, that the people who funded that room for me for 2 weeks to sit through COVID-19 protocol would pull their funding and I would have to go back to prison. Coldest punch in the gut you could probably give a man who waited 26 years. Was I disappointed? Yeah. For about 3 hours, I sat in the room and I shook my head, right? But also before I left prison, I had emails, email addresses, and I had telephone numbers. And so I started reaching out while I was inside of the COVID-19 protocol motel room for 2 weeks making contacts. During those 2 weeks, I got in contact with Nick Amos, or he contacted me from the Venice Basketball League and offered me a job even before I left protocol. And so when I left the motel room after 2 weeks, and then I checked into the transitional home, the very next morning, I had a camera in my face and a documentary being filmed about the Venice Basketball League 2020, the pandemic season. And so after 26 years and getting released on October 16th, 2020, on November 17th, 2020, for the first time outside of a prison, my voice was heard calling basketball at Dotwaller Beach for the Venice Basketball League. And that was probably the most exciting thing that had ever happened to me at that point, because again, I was only out 30 days. Some of the things that really stood out that day, there was a lot of good basketball being played there, but the thing that stood out the most was seeing Kevin Carr, who was inside of San Quentin with me, when I saw him walk up, because he had been released before me, and seeing Caesar McDowell, the chairman of Unite the People, who I know started that organization inside. And both of those guys showed up to the game. And I really, really needed that right then, because you have to understand, I didn't know anybody. Even my niece that was there with me, I didn't know her. The last time I'd seen her, she was a month old. I may have written a few letters to her over the years, but I didn't know her, right? I didn't even know my mother, who showed up later, or my sister-in-law, right? The only people I knew when they showed up that was familiar to me was Kevin Carr and Caesar McDowell. My cousin showed up. My best friend showed up from childhood. I didn't know him, but I knew those two, and it made me more comfortable when I was there. And they stayed there a lot with me. They talked to me. And what they did that day kind of set a pattern for what is taking place for the next 2 years, which is they reminded me of the things that I learned in the self-help groups, right, about all of the emotions that I was feeling in the moment and how to process it and how to work through them. And remember that it's okay to be overwhelmed, right? And it's okay to sit in a place where you're overwhelmed. Just don't let it get the best of you. Just be aware of it. You know, don't not be conscious of it. And because they reminded me of that, ever since then, it was like, okay, anytime I have an issue, I can go back to what I learned in the self-help groups. And so along the path, I did three more days worth of games with the VBL over the next few months, ending in December out in Watts. And then I was picked up by Kevin Daly from the American Basketball Association and started doing games for them, traveling through Southern California from Los Angeles to San Diego, out to the beach areas and everything else, calling games. Because that's what I told the board. I told the board very distinctly. And when they asked me, what is your plan? My plan is to call an NBA Finals. Hopefully it goes 7 games. I want to be either signed to a basketball team or I want to be signed to a network that's covering it so I can get the opportunity to do it. And so everything that I've been doing over the past 2 years has been pursuit of that goal, even though there's 2 goals involved. The second goal is to make sure that I represent what it looks like to be a healthy person after 26 years of incarceration and taking part in self-help groups and opening myself up to learning and to healing and talking to people who went through similar circumstances as I had, because in the beginning, I thought I was the only one. That's how most people feel. I thought I was the only one. I thought that it was just me. I didn't know somebody else went through the same type of things that I went through. And so that's something that's a great responsibility for me. And I feel it a lot. I feel it every day. I don't think people really understand what it feels like to know that anything that I say or do is going to be reflective of over 100,000 people, at least in the state of California, that's incarcerated. But across the nation as well, that's 2.3 million justice impacted people, people who are currently in state prison or county lockup, city jails, people who are on parole, probation, some type of supervision, people who are at juvenile facilities and whatnot. In a sense, I represent all of them, because what the politicians and what the people who want to keep people locked up and keep the people in the car seal system want is a narrative. And I don't fit that narrative. I'm breaking that narrative. That narrative says that I should have went to jail already, that I should have, you know, committed a crime already. That narrative says that there's no faith in the fact that I can come out rehabilitated, that I can actually come out and sit and be in my own presence and experience the last 2 years and go back and forth, swaying to and fro. Because there's been a lot of emotions and there's been a lot of stuff that's taken place in the last 2 years that I didn't understand, because the society that I left was nothing like it is now. So this has all been a relearning process, and it makes me have greater appreciation for the hashtag that I have for myself, rebirth. Rebirth of Chick, because this is a rebirth in a sense. And over the past 2 years, I've been working hard. I've been going from event to event, game to game, and even had to go back to work with my cousin for a while. Went back to plumbing. That was an adventure in and of itself, because it had been 26, 27 years since I picked up anything that looked like a plumbing tool. So the first time we went on a job, and you got to remember, my cousin, I trained him. A lot of the guys that was having me working with them when I went back to plumbing, I trained them, and they would be reminding me, hey, man, you trained me in this. And I'm like, I don't know none of this stuff no more. All I studied inside was languages, spirituality, mathematics, the human body, space, inner space, outer space. I was a study guy, right? That study helped me start those basketball leagues as well, the softball and the basketball league. But before I go to Sentinel, let me finish up on what I've been doing. So now, in April of this year, I signed with Coin Academy after almost 14, 15 months of moving through the city and showing up for event to event and doing play-by-play for any and everybody that need it, anybody and everybody that needs it. And I'm currently the play-by-play voice for the Reseda High School Girls Regents basketball team. That was a good job for me to get. I love that because it keeps me close to the game, right? But I really like the women's game because I don't like the way they disrespect the women's game from the WNBA all the way down, you know, during the WNBA playoffs when they had the WNBA play a game in Georgia. And they didn't even take up the Georgia symbol off the floor in a playoff game for the WNBA. When I saw that, I was like, man, I am getting ready to start focusing on the women's game, right? Because to me, it seemed like they needed a voice. So I'm still looking to do play-by-play for the WNBA or any NCAA women's college team. I'm still looking to get involved with any NBA team that wants me, right? Any college team that wants me, any high school team that wants me. If you want Aaron Showtime Taylor as a voice for you, that's what I'm here for. I do play-by-play. Now, to get like this, right, well, let me back up, because first I talked about what I did after jail. Now I'm supposed to talk about what I did before jail. So let's start there. And I'm going to start on April the 29th, 1992. A year previous to that, there was a video that came out that was shot where we saw a motorist, Rodney King, and he had been pulled over. And by the time the video kicks in, Rodney King is being beat. And that's all you see, him being beat by LAPD police officers. And the video is so, so graphic, right, that nobody can look at it. From the president, even the chief, Daryl Gates, who arguably, in my humble opinion, was one of the biggest racists you could probably find. Even he said that video is an aberration because he knew how bad it looked. And so, like most young black men in the city who had been harassed by police and just thought that the police was the enemy forever at that time, I watched that trial very closely. I missed a lot of work because I was doing plumbing work back then, and I had a little savings that I had, and I wouldn't go to work so I could stay in and watch the results and watch the every day out in Simi Valley as they televised it, the trial of Rodney, the trial of the four police officers who beat Rodney King. And so that particular day, I was out in Compton and I was underneath a house doing some plumbing work. I was cutting out some fresh water pipe and putting some fresh water pipe in when the lady who called us out stomped on the floor and said, Mr. Plumber, the verdicts came in. And I came from underneath the house and I remember standing in her living room with the dirt still coming off my coveralls as the not guilty verdicts came in. And I remember standing in her living room and I remember anger, just white hot anger boiling up in me, like, how could they do this? How could they find these people not guilty? See, you got to understand, social media is new. Everybody has cameras now. Back then, one of the main things that was used to convict people in trials, specifically for bank robbery and shoplifting was videotape evidence. Nobody could refute it because even if you said it didn't happen, there was a camera that didn't have no bias to it that saw what you did. And so if you say you didn't do it and the camera said you did, what are we going to believe, what you say or what we see? And we had been seeing that since the 70s with videotape evidence. Many, many people had been locked up with videotape evidence, yet that same type of evidence was now said not to be enough in a trial where somebody was clearly beat. And so as I drove from Compton over to Crenshaw on 39th, where the plumbing office was at, the guy I was working with kept saying, "I don't think nothing's going to happen tonight." And I looked at him and told him, "You aren't tapped into what's going to take place." Because I was also reflective of a whole lot of other young black men and black people and people who were suffering underneath the system back then. So when I got back home and I stayed on 27th and Arlington, on the ride home, the radio said, if you wanted to voice your frustrations, come over to First AME Church. They had Arsenio Hall, Magic Johnson, and some other people inside of there. And so I went home, bathed, and while I was drying off, I looked at the television and I saw the news coverage of Reginald Denny being beat, right? And I said, it's going down right now. So I went over to First AME Church with a couple of friends of mine from the apartment building. And as we pulled up, distinctly remember Henry Alfaro was there from Channel 7 News back then. And he was near one of the podiums where they had kind of set up a little dais for people to talk into the mic and voice their frustrations because the church was already filled up. They wasn't letting anybody else in there. And the capacity there was 500. And outside the church, it was maybe about 500 or 600 people milling around. Since we couldn't get in, we was outside. And so I remember Henry Alfaro, like I said, and I remember some other cameras being set up. And the day I went up there, I had an X shirt on and I had a beanie that had an X on it. And like I said, I was steaming hot. And so there are other things that I said that day in front of cameras. But this is what I said that day that was recorded and later put on Dr. Dre's The Chronic album, track 3. Titled, The Day the Niggas Took Over. Now, I'ma say this and I'ma end mine. If you ain't down for the Africans here in the United States, period, point blank, if you ain't down for the ones that's suffering in South Africa from apartheid and shit, then you devils need to step your punk ass to the side and let us brothers and us Africans step in and put some foot in that ass. I said that day on April the 29th, 1992. And then, like most young black men, I went into the city. A week later, I was at Jim Brown's house, and Ed Gordon from BET was there, and he was setting up a show called Black Men Speak on Black Men in America. It was live on BET from coast to coast. And he came to Jim Brown's house because that was a hub for all kind of types in the neighborhood, you know, from the gangbanger to the hustler, the pimps, everybody, right? There was a place to meet at Jim Brown's house because it was there that we started to learn how we were supposed to navigate through this new phase we were in. And so while we were up there and there were a lot of A-list celebrities in there that I won't name right now, Ed Gordon's there. And so he has a meeting in a side room and he says, "Hey, I need some people to come on because America needs to hear who you guys are and what's going on because LA is the center, you know, it's ground zero for this right now." And so myself, and a young guy by the name of Trey Young, I believe, and Christopher Williams, and a couple other guys. The video's on definitely on BET, Ed Gordon, Black Men Speak on Black Men in America. It came out May the 6th, 1992, and it was 2 hours live. And I didn't even realize what I had said the week before until in December of 1992 when my brother picked me up in his plumbing truck to go do some work. And he threw the Dr. Dre tape in and we're listening to it. And he said, "You hear that?" And I heard it, but I said, "Damn, that dude sounded like he ready to set it off." He said, "Listen to it again," and rewound it. And I listened to it again. I said, "Wait a minute, play that one more time." "Wait a minute, that's me. I said that at the church the day the riots jumped off." And so that pursuit led nowhere to go try to find out if I could recapture my voice or who had it, how they got it. Was I going to be involved in that? While I was in prison, people would say it. I would hear it all the time when I'm walking the tier. I could hear, you know, somebody playing Dr. Dre the Chronic, and I'll hear that. And I didn't say anything for about the first 10 or 11 years. And then one day, somebody was saying something, and I said, "Yeah, I'm the person that said that." and looked at me like, yeah, right. I said, no, that was me that said that. They was like, for real? And so when I said it again and they played the tape back, they eyes get big. They're like, that was you? Hey, come here. And so that went on all the way up until 2014 in prison. In 2014, the video pops up on YouTube. And there I am with the X beanie on, the X hat, right? The X hat, the X beanie. I'm making the statement. And now everybody can see it's me, right? And somebody asked me, what do I want out of this? What is my end goal, you know, with this Dr. Dre thing? I'm immortalized in history. I said something that was chosen out of all the statements that was made that day, out of all the audio I'm sure they listened to. They came back to that statement. And they said, this is the sentiment that we want to push out with this song. And they chose my voice. Definitely, I want some historical recognition. Definitely, I want people to know who I am, and I want them to know my story. See, I don't want them to just think that I went and did 26 years in prison and I came out and I'm doing play-by-play and now, you know, I'm fortunate enough and blessed to have my own show and possibly more. That's good, but there are other things that I've done, as we're learning today, that a lot of people didn't know about. So yes, I am the voice that starts off track three of the one of, I believe personally, and this is no shade to anybody else, and it's not because I'm on it, but I believe The Chronic is the number one all-time hip-hop album. The all-time number one. Nothing else was like it. And it's not just because my voice was on it, but it did speak to a time. It holds just as much significance to our time in 1992 as Marvin Gaye's album in the 70s on What's Going On. The same significance, because it's speaking to the same cultural things that we was dealing with. Again, when I think about it, I'm like, you've touched some places in history that people don't even realize. And even in this short docu, I'm not going to go into everything yet because there's still more to tease out. But now let's go to Sentinel State Prison, right? My points had went down from Calipat. It's March 2005. And I'm about to leave a level 4 prison where it was kind of like a really, really good community where I can ask any type of question I wanted about anything dealing with spirituality and can most likely get an answer for it. But now I was about to go to a new prison, a lower level. I had heard about level 3s and the staff being a bit more disrespectful than the level 4s, but I was prepared. What I wasn't prepared for was the year before I started the first league, my brother died. This was in May 2006. In fact, he died on Mother's Day, 2006. That same time when I was dealing with that, I was on C Yard at Sentinella and a correctional officer said something to me and I said something back and it was very disrespectful. And as a result of that, I was taken to the hold for 2 days. Thankfully, the lieutenant that heard the initial lockup order knew me and was like, what happened here? And I explained to him, he was like, oh man, we'll just send you to another yard. And so thankfully I ended up over on B Yard. And within a year and a half, I started the softball league on B Yard. The team I had was called the African Stars. It was named after a team that I was an assistant coach on at Lancaster State Prison on the level 4 that actually won a championship. And I like the name the African Stars because the name itself is about being unified as Africans, because that's our cultural identity and history, right? And our cultural birthplace, right? Our ancestral birthplace. And it was talking about the stars. So, you know, I think I'm a star. So I like that. So when I got to the level 3, I started that team again, the African Stars, except this time it was a softball team. And that softball team consisted of at least one person from every area within the black community on the yard. We had 10 players on the field because we was playing underhand slow pitch softball. And I had 3 subs. And sometimes they would get playing time and sometimes they wouldn't. But they was a part of a team. And what that did was spark interest, other than walking around mad-dogging each other on the yard. So once the interest got sparked, that's when me and a few other guys went around and said, okay, look, get your homeboys and get all of them to get a team together, right? Each team give me $25. And at the end of the season, you get 80% of the bag. I'm going to get 5%. And the referees and the people that's taking care of the stats and all that other stuff will get the other 15%. That's how we started our first season. It went good. One thing happened in that season, though, that very first one. If you're familiar with the L.A. gang culture, there was two warring neighborhoods, or two, you know, enemies who ended up in the finals of this softball season. And here I am. I have made myself a arbitrator on the yard between each and every group. I can talk and listen to both sides or three sides, and we can come up with a solution that doesn't involve violence. And I'll never forget this. I was on the right field line, and a ball was hit, and it sailed, and I'm on the line. Now, one team, there's a guy on the team. This guy's real close to me, one of the youngsters. We always talking, right? The other team, I got three or four partners on that team, so I'm not trying to see nobody win or lose, but the ball was foul. And everybody was yelling and screaming, but I'm waving it off as foul. That was the only time in prison that I feared for my life. I thought I was going to get beat up over the next month. That game was so volatile and they were so hot about that call. The one team that lost, they didn't even talk to me for about a month and a half. Every time I came around, they would be looking at me. I'm like, all right, man, I'm going to go on and go. I know y'all don't like the call, but, you know, I couldn't do anything about it. I had to be fair. The other side, you know, the guy that I was close to, he was like, man, I know you straight. I know you wouldn't have made that call for me. I said, man, the way I feel now, I wish I hadn't. But I had to keep it a buck. And that's, I say that to say that's why I had so much trust on the yard, because I was always keeping it real. I was always telling the truth. I was always being open and honest and making myself available. So for the next couple of seasons in basketball, it went just the same way. I did play by play, 3 games a day, 5 days a week, Monday through Friday. Right. We had schedules. We had all-star games. We had fantasy leagues. We had everything you could possibly think of. And this stuff was organized by me. And it was later that I kicked back and thought, I said, wait a minute, man, you actually organized an entire league. You organized a fantasy league to run along with it. You hired referees and got them paid from the money that you got the people to put in. You just created an economy on a prison yard. Now, one thing I know, if I don't know nothing else, if people got money or got the potential to make money, then the need to be violent, hurry up and start shrinking down. Don't nobody want to pay $25 in this and then they lose their money because somebody started fighting. So that's why the violence started getting down on the yard and started reducing, because we created an economy where people was getting paid for playing sports. And also what was taking place inside of that sports, I had the opportunity to minister to those individuals when they came to Juma service. And some of those guys, when they came to Juma service, I told them, Islam may not be for you. You might want to check out one of these other religions and first before you come back here. Because I didn't feel like it was my job to turn people into Muslims. I felt like it was my job to guide them in an area that would suit their spirit. I wasn't going to be responsible for saying you should be this or that. Just go check it all out and see which one fits best for you. And then we can come back and talk about it. And so it wasn't just basketball that was taking place. It was also the ability to have hands-on talking to these youngsters and getting to know them and talking to them and having them trust me. Some of these people would call, the staff would call me out of my cell and send me over to buildings and to a cell where somebody may have just lost a mother or a father, lost a son or a daughter. Hell, there was times when they called me over to the program office while I was at Centinella, and I went back into the counselor's office and the room was dark, and I went in and sat down, and then the voice spoke from the other end of the table. And I'm like, what's going on? And either it's a man or a woman, depending on who called me over there, and they just needed to talk about the marriage, about depression, about anxiety, right? About their kids. It became to the point where it wasn't just about basketball. Again, I was making myself serviceable to everybody at this point, from a spiritual basis and from a sports basis. Plus, I started a paper called The Show while I was at Centinella. And The Show, I didn't have cameras or nothing like that, but I cut out little stuff from Sports Illustrated and other news magazines that dealt with sports. And I would make my cover, and then I would put the stories or whatever happened in the game. I'd have the reporter, Adrian, at the time. He would give it to me. I put everything together in the program office, and then we cop everything up and send it out to the buildings. Each building would get 50 copies of The Show. I didn't realize at the time that a lot of people was mailing The Show home, right? And a lot of guys were telling me that, hey, I never had anything positive to talk about while I was in prison until my name appeared in this paper. You know, 5 block shots in a game, diving catches in the right field with the extended glove. This is how it was described in the paper, and these people were sending that paper home. And then I started to understand the transference, right, of me helping to empower you by putting together these leagues and giving you the opportunity to thrive. And then you do exactly that in the league. And then the paper that's attached to the league talks about it. And you send that home to your family. So many guys sat in front of me and told me their mothers were so proud of them for what they read in the show while we were at Centinella. So many people told me that. So many people. I'm honored. I feel honored to have started that paper because I didn't realize what I was doing. But the feedback that I was getting from that and those guys, I really, 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 really appreciate that. If you see this, man, contact me any way you can. AaronShowtimeTaylor.com. AaronShowtimeTaylor@gmail.com. Contact me if you have any copies of the show so we can get them on this show, Hard in the Paint. Also inside of these leagues, right, again, there was all sorts of business dealings going on or business models and setups inside of the CBL. At the time, it was called the Convicts All-Star Basketball League. Later, when I got to San Quentin, we changed it to the Championship Basketball League. But the structure of it was set up so nice, so organizationally sound, that even I, as a commissioner, was held to the same standard as all the players, right? Players got charged $1 per tech. That's how referees got paid. But as a commissioner, I had to make sure that the referees wasn't over-teching people on some nonsense just so they can get an extra buck or two so it can be more money in there. No, we didn't do that. But even if I did something, I could be held accountable by players, coaches, and the head referee. That's how we set it up to make sure that everybody was accountable and everybody was responsible. If a person didn't pay their tech, he didn't have to pay that tech. He just couldn't get back on the court. And the team had the responsibility to make him pay that tech. It wasn't on the commissioner. It wasn't on the referees or nobody. It was on the team because each team invested the same amount of money. So each team had to hold each other accountable and responsible to the decisions that was taking place involved in this league. This taught a lot of accountability, a lot of responsibility. And like I said, it gave me the opportunity to minister and help people spiritually. It also gave me the opportunity to lower some of the stigmas that was involved with people who went to the self-help groups. The self-help groups they had at Centinella, one, Life or Parenting Group, didn't last long, but I did go in there. Two, Alcoholics Anonymous, Narcotics Anonymous. That one didn't last long either. But again, I went there a couple of times and got what I needed to get. But when we came to Alternatives to Violence and Cage Your Rage, these were two self-help groups that came consistently on a rotation, at least three times a year, each one. And you sat in there, right, and you opened yourself up to an experience of learning about yourself, but you had to do it in a room with other people. So there had to be a standard of trust in that room. There was a contract that everybody had that you could not talk about what took place in this room. You don't repeat it outside this room because people are going to open up. I went in there seeking one thing, just to learn some stuff. And I actually started learning about myself. And because I could see it was helping me, when I was able to go out on the yard, I was able to communicate that to those youngsters. Hey, there's nothing wrong with going to a self-help group. I'm going in there. You go to self-help group? Yeah, every time they come. You know what I'm saying? You have to heal up. We can't be the same people going out that we was when we came in. That started back there. That started back when I was ministering with those youngsters. I learned back then to get outside of myself. I didn't want to run that basketball league. I said it on the Greatest Stories You Never Heard for Steph Curry's company. I didn't want to do it. But if I didn't do it, I couldn't go to my religious services on a regular basis. So I had to do it. Not just for me, but for everybody else that wanted to get to their religious services. Not just for the people who wanted to get to their religious services, but for the people who wanted to go to canteen on a regular basis and not miss what they had for them. And thankfully, I learned a lot about selfless work. It thickened my skin up because I had people cussing me out all the time and I couldn't respond to it because I would have been responding from ego. But I knew my reputation was bigger than what people were saying. So I had to learn to understand that an athlete in the moment is liable to say anything based on the emotional charge that they have. And I, as the commissioner, or if I'm wearing stripes as a game official, have to understand where they're coming from emotionally and not respond to that. Not respond to it. And that was something that I learned while I was at Centinella as well. I learned humility. I learned patience. I even learned how to communicate, even though later when I was at San Quentin, I actually took a communications class. I took a communications class and got better. But up until that point, I had no classes. So everything I was doing was just repetition and what I learned in a book. And we took that type of stuff and we applied it to the basketball league and gave young men an opportunity to actually open up. This was before I got to San Quentin. This is what I was doing this in El Centro, California, down at Sentinel Estate Prison. This is what I've been doing for a long time. And I don't mind doing it. The best thing that I have going for me ever since I came home from prison is being wide open and tell the truth. That's the best currency I have for me right now. Just to be who I am, open, honest. I can't miss with that. I don't have to try to remember a lie or try to remember a story a certain way. You know, sometimes you might listen to somebody, the story that started off the car was a Ford Mustang, and then all of a sudden the car went from a Ford and it turned into a Porsche. And, you know, it turned after a Porsche, it turned into something else and probably was flying after that. We don't want stories like that. We want a consistent truth. And that's what I represent. And that's what I'm here to do. My name is Aaron Showtime Taylor. What I am trying to do is something that no other person who's been released from prison has done before. I'm trying to change the narrative.